The American History Podcast, Episode 11, The Middle Colonies and Colonial Culture.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Morswick.
Okay, so welcome back, and welcome to the new Patreon bonus series. Now, last time we talked New England, and so this time we're going to delve a bit into the Middle Colonies. Now, I know y'all are used to getting the Song of the Week, so here you go. This week, the Song of the Week is "A Fox May Steal Your Hens, Sir." It's a bit more bawdy than I'd allow on the main feed, so just keep that in mind. All right, so here we go, and I'll see you in a few minutes.
But now, Polly, to your affair, for matters must not be left as they are. You're married, then, it seems?
Yes, sir.
And had you not the common views of a gentlewoman in your marriage, Polly?
I do not know what you mean, sir.
Of a jointure and of being a widow. Why, that is the whole scheme and intention of all marriage articles. The comfortable estate of widowhood is the only hope that keeps up a wife's spirit. If you have any views of this sort, Polly, I shall think the match not so very unreasonable.
Oh, I dread to hear your advice.
Secure what he hath got. Have him peached at the next sessions, and then at once you are made a rich widow.
What? Murder the man I love? The blood runs cold at my heart with the very thought of it.
Thy husband now.
All right, so today let's discuss the Middle Colonies. We're going to focus mainly on New York and Pennsylvania, and I'm sure this will probably upset any fans that we have in New Jersey or Delaware, but it's really just to make this episode more manageable. Now, if I didn't cut out two colonies, then this would be a beast of an episode, which I've done before, but I'm not interested in doing that right now, so I apologize for leaving out a couple of states. Now, in general, the region was excellent for farming. It was so good, in fact, that it became known as the bread colonies for exports of grain. Also, fruits and vegetables were grown here. Now, there were three rivers, and I'm going to probably butcher at least one of them, the Susquehanna, the Delaware, and the Hudson, which were essential for tapping into the fur trade in the interior of the continent. Now, of course, the fur trade was essential for making money. Furthermore, these colonies, with the exception of New York, tended to be less aristocratic than the North, than the South and New England. Landholdings were generally smaller than the South, but mostly larger than, again, New England. While it had more industry than the South, it was less industrial than their northern cousins, and finally, it had a more ethnically mixed population. It was more democratic, and it was religiously tolerant, something one would not say about the New England area. Now, before we go further, let's look closely at the first of the two major colonies, New York. Now, the colony started off as a Dutch colony called New Amsterdam. Now, Henry Hudson, an Englishman in the employment of the Dutch East India Company, sailed into Delaware and New York Bays in 1609 and traveled up the Hudson River. Later, New Netherlands was founded in 1623 on the Hudson River by a man named Peter Minuit. He had established the Dutch West India Company to profit off the fur trade, and he also bought Manhattan Island from Indians for about $30. Oddly enough, the tribe which sold him the land did not actually own it, but the Dutch claimed the land anyway. Now, New York City, called New Amsterdam at the time, was founded as a company seaport, and it was run by the Dutch West India Company, in the interests, of course, of company stockholders. Now, part of the thinking behind the creation of the settlement was to protect the entrance to the Hudson River. Thus, in 1624, about 30 families were moved to Manhattan Island, where a citadel was being built. In 1625, a war in the Hudson Valley between the Mohican and Mohawks caused the Dutch to move even more settlers into the vicinity of Fort Amsterdam, ostensibly for their own protection. Now, life in the colony was quite different from, say, the British colonies in Virginia and even from the Puritans in New England. There was little religious toleration, little to no freedom of speech, and there were no democratic practices. Now, another characteristic of the Dutch settlement in what would become New York was the existence of a practice known as patroonship. By the way, if you don't know, I had a dental procedure done. I grind my teeth at night, and I know this is not part of the narrative, but if you wonder if I'm sounding a little weird, it's because I grind my teeth at night, and I had a molar that had to be removed in the back, and once that's healed up, they're going to put in a bridge there. So just if you're wondering why do I sound kind of lispy or something, that's it. I just wanted to apologize for that. All right, so back to the actual narrative. Now, patroonship, this was an aristocratic system resembling medieval serfdom. Huge estates were granted to promoters who would settle 50 persons on the estate. And these were quite large, with one being bigger than the entirety of Rhode Island itself. So again, the Dutch colony was quite different than the English colonies. However, after repeated protests, a semi-representative body was finally granted. The town which became New York was, however, by the 1640s, already quite cosmopolitan, with 18 different languages being spoken. Now, just as other colonies faced challenges, so too did New Netherlands. First, violence on the part of Dutch settlers against natives led to reciprocity. For protection, the Dutch built a wall, which was located where modern-day Wall Street is in New York City, thus the name. Second, New England, seeing the Dutch colony as a threat, was hostile to the growth of the Dutch colony. Third, Swedish settlers trespassed on the Dutch lands along the Delaware River, establishing New Sweden between 1638 and 1655. Now the Dutch, led by Peter Stuyvesant, and I probably just butchered that, ended Swedish rule and the colonists were absorbed into the New Netherlands. Fourth, in 1664, King Charles II of England ordered the military removal of the Dutch from New Netherlands. Now, Peter Stuyvesant, he was forced to surrender without firing a shot, and the king's brother, the Duke of York, was given control over the area, and the name was soon changed to New York, and it became a proprietary colony. Now, if you don't remember, a proprietary colony was one in which the grant was made to an individual or a group by the British Crown, and it, the colony, was granted full rights of self-government. Now, in 1683, New York was reorganized and issued a document known as the Charter of Liberties. It granted freedom of religion to all Christians and gave all landholders the right to vote. This was a modest step, leading to democracy in New York, but a step forward nonetheless. Now, there were two limitations. First, the fact that most of the land was in the hands of a few landholders and speculators. Second, New York retained its feudalistic traits more than any other colony in the North, and in many ways resembled the plantation owners of the South. The charter was revoked in 1685 when James II became king and made New York a royal colony. Now, in the decades which followed, New York flourished under English rule, profiting from trade with the Iroquois and attracting agricultural workers as well. However, the colony was still autocratic in nature, and this helped to discourage some Europeans from coming to the colony. And that explains why the growth in population was retarded at that point. A response to this was an event known as Leisler's Rebellion in New York City in 1691. Remnants of patroonships caused discontent as huge estates were parceled out to upper-class whites, crowding out the poor farmers. Jacob Leisler, governor of New York between 1689 and 1691, and he introduced some democratic practices as well as land redistribution to the poor. However, in 1691, the English tried to remove him, and in response, a combination of poor whites and farmers led by Leisler put up an armed resistance. Inspired by the Glorious Revolution of 1689 and the overthrow of the Dominion of New England, the revolt was a failure. Leisler was hanged, and the parceling out of huge estates continued. However, the significance of the revolt is that it demonstrated the growing disaffection of the lower classes against the privileged classes. Now, the other colony that I'd like to talk about today is Pennsylvania. But first, we've got to discuss the Quakers. Now, the Quakers were a religious movement which emerged in the 1600s and they were officially known as the Religious Society of Friends. They were a nonconformist in nature and more radical than the Puritans in their opposition to authority. Again, as I've probably said in an earlier episode, these are my kind of friends. They opposed the authorities in five ways. Now, first, they refused to support the Anglican Church with taxes. Second, they did not follow the other Christian denominations and had no paid clergy. Third, they took no oaths. Fourth, they made no deference to authority figures. Have I said how much I love these guys? Well, I love these guys. And fifth, they were pacifists. They refused military service and advocated passive resistance. What else can we say about the Quakers? They were simple and democratic, seeking religious and civic freedom. They believed in an inner light, not scripture or hierarchy, and they saw all men as equal in the eyes of God. Finally, they were persecuted in New England and in other colonies due to the fact that they opposed authority. They would not have been loved in my previous school district that I taught in, let me tell you. Okay, now with that in mind, back to Pennsylvania. William Penn was granted a huge tract of land in 1681 from the king. This was payment for a previously owed debt. The king owed money to the Penn family, and this allowed Penn to create a haven for Quakers. A secondary motive was that they could experiment with liberal ideas in government while making a profit. Eventually, Pennsylvania became the best advertised of all colonies. Pamphlets distributed in England and the Netherlands, France and Germany attracted settlers from throughout Europe. The pamphlets promised land, freedom of religion, and representative government. It was these generous policies which attracted many immigrants who were looking for land. It also attracted carpenters, masons, shoemakers, and other manual laborers. Now, in the end, Pennsylvania was a success. All of the Swedes, Finns, and Dutch in the area became naturalized. Philadelphia itself was carefully planned and became one of the largest cities in North America. Another accomplishment was the establishment of representative government, with landowners having voting rights. Now, amongst its other characteristics, Pennsylvania had no church that was supported through taxes. They had freedom of worship guaranteed to all residents. There was also no provision for military defense, as to have such a plan went against Quaker pacifist doctrine. Finally, the Quakers were strongly against slavery, and Penn purchased land from the Indians, with whom the Quakers in general had excellent relations. However, by the mid-17th century, relations did begin to deteriorate for a couple of reasons. Number one, the Walking Purchase of 1737 swindled the Lenape, or the Delaware Indians, out of hundreds of thousands of acres. And secondly, and quite unfortunately, Penn's descendants were less interested in building on the good relationship with natives that William Penn had fostered. By 1700, Pennsylvania was the fourth largest colony, behind only Virginia, Massachusetts, and Maryland. The Quakers, shrewd businessmen, exported grain and other foodstuffs, and the colony itself attracted a large German population, thus making it quite cosmopolitan when compared to, say, Massachusetts. Okay, what can we say of British colonial America in the 18th century? First, it was characterized by an enormous population growth, a feature common to the 13 colonies at the time. Demographic changes meant there was a shift in the balance of power between the colonies and England. In 1700, the colonies had less than 300,000 people. By 1775, there were 2.5 million, 20% of whom were of African descent. Furthermore, there was a high rate of fertility in the colonies. This meant the ratio of English immigrants for each American-born colonist dropped greatly. The ratio in 1700 was 20 to 1. By 1775, it was 3 to 1. Thus, more and more, the people of the colonies were becoming untied from England, and many of them, by 1775, had never even been to England, having been born and lived all of their lives in the New World. Now, some other characteristics. The largest colonies were Virginia, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Maryland. There were four major cities, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and Charleston. In the early 18th century, about 90% of the colonists lived in rural areas. By the Revolution, it was about 80%. Now, this brings up a theme that you hear quite often, or at least you used to hear, and that's the idea that America was a melting pot. Now, sometimes this period is referred to, when speaking of immigration, as the old immigration. First, the British American colonies had the most mixed population in perhaps the entire world, despite the fact they were mainly English. The South held 90% of the slaves, but there were slaves in other areas as well. Of all three areas, New England was the least ethnically mixed. It was predominantly English. The most mixed were the middle colonies. But outside of New England, about half of the population was non-English. So if we did a population breakdown, we would see that by 1790, people of English and Welsh descent made up about two-thirds of the population. English was the dominant language, and British institutions dominated the colonies. Having said that, there were places, for example, in Pennsylvania, where no English was spoken at all. By 1775, one-fifth of the population was African, and while it was mostly concentrated in the South, there were Africans, both free and slave, in the Middle Colonies and in New England as well. Scots-Irish and Scots-Highlanders were about 6% of the population. These folks were often Presbyterian Scot lowlanders, many of whom became squatters on frontier lands and fought Native Americans for that land. Just as an FYI, squatters were settlers who moved onto the land without permission or legal title to it. Eventually, they moved south into the backcountry of Maryland, western Virginia, and the western Carolinas. They hated the British for uprooting them earlier from Scotland and were often, if not always, poor. Thousands of these people came to America in the early 1700s, mostly in Pennsylvania. You also had the Scots Highlanders, a relatively small group and often loyal to the crown, and they were relatively well off, especially compared to their brethren. Now, the next major group was the German immigrants. They're about 5% of the total. They fled religious persecution, economic oppression, and war in the early 1700s. They ended up settling mostly in Pennsylvania and made up about one-third of the population. They were primarily Lutheran and had no loyalty to the British crown whatsoever. For the most part, they maintained their German language and customs to such an extent that you could travel throughout parts of Pennsylvania and never hear anything but German being spoken. The rest of the immigrants broke down into the Dutch, who are 2% of the total, and concentrated in New York and New Jersey, which of course makes sense based on the history of that area. The Irish, you might be surprised, only comprised 2% of the total at this point. The heyday for Irish immigration would not be until the mid-19th century. The French made up only 0.4% of the total, which is not too surprising, as the French never really had a large impact on North America, with the exception of Louisiana and Quebec. So the structure of colonial society. And without a doubt, there was stratification by the mid-18th century. You had a small upper class made up of, depending where you were, aristocratic plantation owners in the South and merchants, lawyers, officials, and clergymen in the North. Now, yeoman farmers were the majority of the population. Small merchants, manual workers, hired hands were next. These were the people who owned no land, and they were more than you perhaps realize. They were also quite important to the freedoms we celebrate today, but more about that later. Indentured servants and jailbirds, they had limited influence. Or did they? Again, more in a moment. And finally, slaves, who made up 20% of the population. Americans, at the end of the day, had the highest standard of living in the world. Not bad for a place that had existed for only about 150 years, give or take. So here comes the controversial bit of the episode. Now, originally, my response was, hey, it's the final episode of season one, so let's bust some myths, right? Obviously, this is no longer the end of season one, but we'll bust some myths anyways. As historian Thaddeus Russell notes in his Renegade History of the United States, the colonies were nurseries not of democracy, but of debauchery and vice. On just about every block of every city in the colonies, there was a place where you could drink, dance, have sex, argue politics, gamble, or just carouse with men, women, children, whites, blacks, Indians, the rich, the poor, the middling. And there was a lot of this going on. Now, another historian, Sharon V. Salinger, author of Taverns and Drinking in Early America, says the cities were packed with taverns. And that's a quote. Now, just some facts about drinking. Philadelphia, where the First Continental Congress met, had approximately one tavern for every 100 people. Today, it has a ratio of about 1 to 1,000. New York and many other American cities had an even greater density of taverns to residents. As a matter of fact, there were so many taverns in New York that the entire population could drink in a tavern at the same time. That's a lot of taverns. So what was it like in these taverns? If you went into one of them, you would have heard a hybrid, flagrantly sexual sound that was the first American urban music. After your eyes adjusted to the darkness, you would have seen white men and black men sitting together, keeping time to the music. White women would be dancing with black men, and black women dancing with white men. You probably would also see prostitutes openly and shamelessly selling their services. Finally, the woman behind the bar selling the drinks may have also owned the establishment. This, in many ways, was democracy at work, and these places were ahead of their time. Now, another thing that you would notice is that these people drank a lot of booze. How much? About 6.5 gallons of alcohol per year, or about 6 shot glasses of 80 proof liquor every single day. Now, this is for each and every adult over the age of 15. By the way, this does not include the consumption of beer or greatly underestimates it. Historian W.J. Warbaugh refers to this period as America's great alcoholic binge. Further, another thing that you notice is that people mix work with drinking. It was not frowned upon. It was actually totally expected. Laborers of all sorts drank beer throughout the day as they worked, and they often took breaks to rest and drink. In the early American economy, the worker, not the boss, decided when he was going to show up and when he was going to go home. Long afternoons of eating, drinking, and sleeping were par for the course. Even stranger to our ears is the work week. After Sunday came St. Monday, another day of rest. This held true even in New England, where even though the Puritan influence remained strong in the 18th century, one could often find a tavern situated next to a church so you could have a drink before and after the ceremony. And the result of this, as Russell notes, is the enlarging of freedom for everyone, but especially blacks. Taverns, but especially the lower class establishments, were the first racially integrated public spaces in America. Black, white, and brown people came together through a mutual desire to enjoy themselves, centuries before the federal government forced them to do so. Believe it or not, there were laws in the colonies barring this sort of behavior, but tavern owners simply ignored the laws, as did the white patrons, the free blacks, and even the slaves who visited these establishments. The color line was, in many cases, totally disregarded. These people, these drunkards, these laggards, these deviants, expanded American freedom simply by doing what they wanted to do, when they wanted to do it. They expanded freedom for the Americans who followed in their footsteps. These renegades were important, and they deserve to be given credit for expanding our freedom. So what can we take away from all this? Society in the colonies was not as pure or as puritanical as you might think. Indeed, in many ways, it was probably far less puritanical than our own society. Or the non-elite were less puritanical. The elite, as always, were not fans of pop culture, and only reluctantly have they allowed the masses to influence what is considered allowable in polite company. Okay, now originally, here's what I said at the end of this episode. That's it for season one, at least for now. I say this in 2021 as I'm redoing this one again. Actually, it's now 2023 and I'm redoing it for a third time. It was remastered in 2020. It will be now remastered again in 2023. There were issues with all of these versions. So this is the remastered version of the remaster, something like that. Anyways, I hope you've enjoyed this jaunt through colonial American history as much as I have. Or I guess as I did back in 2020 and 2018. Anyways, whatever. The point is that this is not really the end of season one, at least not for you all. We're going to get more episodes shortly. So thank you for listening, my dear Patreons, and I will see you soon. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.